Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is University of Texas historian H.W. Brands, author of a number of acclaimed histories and biographies. His subjects have ranged from presidents and founding fathers to the California Gold Rush, the Gilded Age, and the Texas Independence story. His best-known books include The First American about Benjamin Franklin, Traitor to His Class about FDR, and American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism. His latest book calls for a re-examination of the generalship and presidency of Ulysses S. Grant. In The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses Grant in War and Peace, published by Doubleday, Brands argues that Grant was a much better general than historians have given him credit for, that the campaign that ended the Confederacy was more than a bloody war of attrition, that his presidency, widely criticized, wasn't as bad as most historians say. Brands points to the Grant administration as the best presidency on civil rights until after World War II. And while there were scandals in his administration, his leadership was important at a critical juncture in American history. H.W. Brands will be the guest of Booksmart Tulsa and Gilcrease Museum this Thursday evening at 7. He'll be giving a lecture and signing, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. H.W. Brands, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Delighted to be with you, Rich.
This book, the new book, is a major reassessment of Ulysses S. Grant, both in war and in the post-Civil War peace, because while we all know that Grant was a military hero, a lot of times historians have looked at his tactics as basically being a war of attrition, and you reassess his tactical brilliance in the Civil War and as well in the post-Civil War peace. Why has Grant received such a bad reputation? Not necessarily for war, to an extent, but really for his presidency.
You know, Rich, there is the old cliche that the victors write the history. And maybe that's usually true. But it wasn't true in the case of the Civil War, because the overriding interpretation of the Civil War, starting about 1875, was influenced very strongly by the Southern view of the lost cause. So Grant had to be acknowledged as the person who had won the war, of course. But that wasn't because of his greater skill. It was easy to say that Lee was the more brilliant general. Grant simply ground him down. The South lost not because of any particular flaw in its philosophy, but because it was outnumbered. And if you're outnumbered in war, then you can explain your defeat. And as for his presidential career, that was a matter of, again, a reinterpretation, and a reinterpretation from the Southern side. Because as the South re-entered the Union, there was a strong incentive for Southerners to interpret Reconstruction as this carnival of corruption, where carpetbaggers and unqualified and ignorant African Americans held positions in state governments in the South that they never should have had. Well, that view caught on, in large part because some of the great historians of the next half century or so were Southerners. And, of course, the South has always been almost obsessed with history, especially the history of the Civil War. And even as late as the 1960s, when those attitudes were changing, when the civil rights movement came along, and one might have thought that Grant's reputation would be reconsidered, because he really was the only president between Lincoln and Lyndon Johnson to take civil rights for African Americans at all seriously. But by then, what was happening simultaneously to the civil rights movement was the anti-Vietnam War movement, especially on campuses and among academic historians. So even though they might have been willing to bump Grant up a notch or two with respect to his presidency, the fact that he became famous for being a general, well, when academic historians were turning away from the military in Vietnam, they also turned away from military history. And so Grant really couldn't catch a break there either.
You know, it's interesting, when I first began reading history in the 1960s, the encyclopedia, if you look for the Civil War, you didn't find it under the Civil War. You found it under the War Between the States. This gives you an example of that influence of the Southern historians, because that was
definitely
the Southern preferred definition, War Between the States, as opposed to the U.S. Civil War.
Well, and there's the more extreme version, which is the War of Northern Aggression.
Yeah.
but that attitude, you know, the War Between the States, because what that really does, if you accept that label, then it puts the North and the South on an absolutely equal footing. And that's the Southern view, but that was entirely the opposite of the view held by Lincoln and Grant and those who fought to hold the Union together.
Now, you mentioned scandals, because when we think of Grant as a president, we do think of scandals. And certainly there were a number of scandals, but they really didn't pertain to Reconstruction as much as they did to Well, a Secretary of War taking kickbacks to name an Indian Post Commissioner, Trading Post Commissioner here in Oklahoma, Fort Sill. You know, various scandals about the growth of government and really as the country is growing to the West.
In fact, that's exactly right. The scandals weren't so much about Reconstruction as about construction. And they started with the scandal over bribes in Congress regarding the construction of the Union Pacific Railroad. And they involved the construction of a new courthouse in New York City where the Tweed Ring, Boss Tweed and his Tammany Hall cronies, siphoned off millions and millions of dollars. Now, one of the ironies of that is those were very large scandals, and they were in the Grant era, but neither one had anything to do with Grant at all. There were scandals in Grant's administration, largely the result of Grant's unwillingness to fire people who had served him well during the Civil War. He had a personal loyalty that probably did not serve him very well as president. And so much of the scandal-plagued Reconstruction era, the whole scandals of the Gilded Age, get dumped in Grant's lap when, yeah, his administration did have some scandals, but the really big ones had nothing to do with him. And the last thing about it is that these scandals, we see them as clearly scandalous. But one of the reasons that they occurred was that the country was industrializing very rapidly, and the relationship between government and the private sector was changing. And no one knew exactly what was legal or ethical and what was not. So, for example, there was an attempt, which Grant did break up, to corner the gold market, led by the arch speculators Jay Gould and Jim Fisk. And now it is true that they sort of tried to bribe members of the administration. What they really did, it's unclear that they did anything that was actually criminal, because what they did was to cut members of the administration in on the speculation. Well, this was standard practice. There were no laws against members of Congress, for example, owning shares of stock in corporations that got federal subsidies. So even there, it was a matter of things were changing so fast. They were changing much faster than the regulations. And I might add, this is a story that goes on, you know, until today. The whole business of the financial meltdown of 2008 was the fact that there were innovations in the financial sector that outpaced the ability of the regulators to keep up.
And a great lobbying effort by those innovators to keep it from coming under regulation as well.
And lobbyists were hard at work back in the Gilded Age as well.
Interesting. I learned a lot about Grant as far as his presidency. You know, we think of Grant being the era of Reconstruction, but just how involved he was in following Lincoln's examples of bringing the South back in, but conditions in the South, he basically was, for a good part of his presidency, still subduing the South, even though the war was over.
Yeah, well, this was something that Grant did very reluctantly, but actually he went into politics reluctantly. As a soldier, he had long disdained politicians, because politicians have to compromise, politicians have to pander for votes and all that stuff, and Grant didn't like that. As a soldier, he wanted things clean and neat. But he allowed himself to be drawn into politics when it became apparent that the victory that had been won on the battlefield was being lost in the political realm. And he realized that he was and could be a unifying figure. He was also pretty much the last of the Lincoln Republicans. The Republican Party had from the beginning been a coalition of anti-slavery elements and pro-business advocates. And these two wings of the party made common cause during the Civil War. But once the war ended, once the slaves were emancipated, then the pro-business wing of the party increasingly took precedence. And what they wanted to do, essentially, was to leave the freedmen, the former slaves, to the tender mercies of the South and get on with industrializing the country. And Grant was one of the last holdouts. And this is why, when Grant took on the Ku Klux Klan in South Carolina, he was able to persuade Congress to pass the so-called Ku Klux Klan Act that gave him remarkable authority to suspend habeas corpus and use the military against the Klan. And he did this successfully. Grant broke up the Klan, which didn't reemerge until the 20th century. But he could only do this once or twice. He knew that using the military during peacetime was a wasting asset. And he had to deal with the fact, and this was what made Reconstruction such a conundrum, that The Civil War was the easy part, because then you could coerce the people who disagreed with you. But once peace set in, then you had to persuade them. And if they wouldn't be persuaded, then, you know, how are you going to reamalgamate the South into the North? How are you going to get Southern, the white Southern majorities, to recognize and honor the civil rights of African Americans?
In many cases, Grant was probably the greatest defender of African American rights in the South. Probably you have to go maybe as far up as Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Actually, I would go farther than that, because Roosevelt was asked to support a federal anti-lynching law in the 1930s,
That's true.
He refused, because he needed to maintain cordial relations with white Southern conservatives. You really have to come all the way up to the 1960s, to Lyndon Johnson, to find somebody who took the part of African Americans the way Grant did. And it was a very lonely position. He got criticized from within his own party, and he naturally got criticized from the Democrats. And this is why Grant is never going to be considered one of the great presidents in terms of accomplishments. The deck was simply stacked against him. It was Lincoln's good historical fate, if not personal fate, to die, to be killed when he did. If Lincoln had lived into Reconstruction, then when things got really messy, his reputation would have been sullied much as Grant's did.
And his predecessor, Andrew Johnson.
Andrew Johnson. Well, Andrew Johnson was in an impossible position because he had no support. He was from the wrong party.
He was a Democrat. Tennessee Democrat, yeah.
Yeah, he was a Southerner when the Northerners had won, and he was a president when Congress was trying to regain control of federal policy. So Grant was the obvious choice to succeed him, but things didn't really get much easier under Grant. You know, so any president would have had a reputation tarnished by being president during Reconstruction, but what we can remember Grant for is standing up for the moral principles of democracy and equality when almost everybody around him wanted to abandon them in the pursuit of industrialization, in the pursuit of economic development.
And you mentioned the idea of the changing standards. One of the things he also worked hard to try to get into place, but it really didn't happen until after him, was civil service, what we would know as civil service. Getting rid of the patronage and the cronyism that was always a part of government prior to that time and was for decades afterwards.
And this was a principal reason that presidential campaigns were so bitterly contested, because if a new president of a different party came into office, then thousands and thousands of jobs would change hands. And this is one of the reasons that even when a large wing of the Republican Party began to object to Grant's, what they considered Grant's excessive concern for equality for African Americans, the Republicans were still willing to nominate him. If he had raised a finger, he could have been nominated for a third term in 1876, and he almost was nominated in 1880, because the Republicans knew that Grant was enormously popular with the electorate. And if a Republican was elected president, then there would be all of that patronage.
Interesting that the concern for civil rights also extended to Native Americans as well. This was, for most of his presidency, a period where he tried to treat the Western tribes, which were the ones that were in the process of losing their lands, humanely and with some sympathy towards their position, even though he realized that this tide was moving west, with or without him.
By the end of the Civil War, many Americans believed that the outcome for the Native Americans was going to be extermination, pure and simple. And while some shed tears over that, others said, well, it's probably just as well. Grant refused to accept that. Grant believed that something must be done from America's good faith, America's honor, and simple humanitarianism to give the Indians a place to live. And so it was Grant who promoted the whole idea of giving Indians reservations in the West, land that would be theirs, and theirs forever. Grant tried this, and he succeeded at first. He also took administration out of Indian policy, away from the Army, which had had it for a long time, and gave it, well, sometimes this policy was called the Quaker policy, because the Indian agents were often appointed by the Quakers, because they seemed to be the only ones who didn't have a mercenary interest in all of this. And Grant's policy succeeded briefly, but eventually the weight of Western immigration worked against him. And the best example was Grant had, helped the Sioux have a reservation in Dakota Territory around the Black Hills, which were sacred to the Sioux. But word got out in the early 1870s that there was gold in the Black Hills. Grant did his best to keep settlers, to keep prospectors and gold hunters out of that area. Initially, he used the army to keep them out, but he couldn't overrule Congress, and Congress wanted to investigate. So it was at the behest of Congress that Grant sent George Custer into the Black Hills. It confirmed that there was gold, and this led to the battles on the plains that ultimately included Custer's demise at the Little Bighorn.
Yeah. My guest today is historian H.W. Brands, Bill Brands. His latest book is The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses Grant in War and Peace. This follows up a number of books about some of America's greatest figures, most recently FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And this is a reassessment of Ulysses Grant, both in peacetime and in war. Let's talk about his military career. Early life, his family didn't seem very politically connected, but they must have had some connections because he got an appointment to West Point, was undistinguished at West Point, but then he served in the Mexican War right after, pretty much within a year or so of graduation. And he served with both Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott, the major generals of the Mexican War. And as I read the text, you can see that the way he would operate in wartime was very much influenced by Zachary Taylor.
Most definitely. Grant was not one to put on airs. He was not one to try to draw attention to himself. He recognized there was something about Winfield Scott who did put on airs, who dressed in all the uniform that he was allowed on every opportunity. And he saw that that impressed a lot of people. But on the other hand, he really was taken by the style of Zachary Taylor, who was much more low-key, who was much more attuned to the needs of the rank and file. And you can almost see Grant saying, if I should ever be in that position, Taylor is the one that I will use to model myself after. One of the things that Grant discovered in the Mexican War very briefly was that he was actually pretty good at this soldiering. He tells in his memoir the story of how when he marched into battle for the very first time, he was as nervous and afraid as anyone could be. And he says that if he'd had the moral courage, he would have turned around and run the other way. But he wouldn't be able to stand the ridicule and opprobrium that would accompany that. So into battle he went. And once the bullets started flying, once the cannons started blasting, he realized that he wasn't afraid anymore. He calmed down, and he had the peculiar ability to grow calmer as the situation around him grew more chaotic. Now, at that time, he had no idea that he would eventually be a general in the middle of the greatest war in American history. But he did recognize that. There was something else that he recognized, and that was, as afraid as he was marching into battle, he was able to realize that the enemy soldiers were just as afraid. And so it kind of normalized the whole thing. If the war with Mexico had gone on for 10 years, Grant would have happily continued the fight, except for the fact that he was far away from his fiancée. But war suited him. Peace didn't. The war ended, and Grant, well, he didn't get mustered out because he didn't know what else to do with himself, but he had to try to make a living in Gold Rush, California, to which he was sent, on a soldier's salary, and that wasn't working well. He got lonely, he drank too much, and he resigned from the military. And then he spent the next 6 years just stumbling and bumbling from one thing to another, until finally he had to take a job in his father's leather business. It was a last resort for him because he'd never wanted to go into it. And he essentially resigned himself to a life of mediocrity as far ahead as he could see. And then came the Civil War and rescued him.
He also had what became apparent in the book was, you mentioned this sort of fear of cowardice under fire, but he also had this sense of if things weren't going the way he wanted them to go, he said, okay, I'm out of here. And he did that in the military when it looked like he was going to be court-martialed because he had a drink. In fact, as you write in the book, everyone was drinking in this Oregon post because it was out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
But throughout the Civil War, several times, if his resignation had been accepted, he wouldn't have been the U.S. Grant that we know.
Yeah. The business about the drinking, Grant's problem was not that he drank too much. The problem was that he couldn't hold his liquor. As you point out, he was on the West Coast, and he was in a post, in a situation where everybody drank. But in the Army, if you were an officer, you were expected to be able to drink like a gentleman. You could hold your liquor. Grant drank with him, but he just couldn't hold his liquor. After one drink, his words started getting slurred, and after two, he looked like he was falling down drunk. I investigated this question about Grant's drinking because this is the one thing when I would tell people that I was working on the book, they'd say, oh, yeah, Grant the drunk. Well, you know, Grant wasn't a drunk. He did get drunk occasionally, but I looked very closely and I found no instance where Grant got drunk, where anything was on the line. There were one or two cases during the Civil War, for example, once during the Siege of Vicksburg. Well, but nothing was happening, and they were just sort of waiting for the Confederates to surrender. I didn't encounter any moments in the White House when he got drunk. But it's one of those labels that's easy to pin on somebody. That's Grant the drunkard, Grant the butcher. You know, the business of Grant the butcher, that he sacrificed too many lives. Well, it seemed that way at the time, but that's because the Civil War was simply far more violent than any war America had ever gotten into before. So whoever the Union commander would have been labeled a butcher. It's quite true. The casualties were appalling. But that's what it took to win the war, and Grant realized that.
And it's interesting, reading his Mexico War Service, he wrote several times to Julia, who would become his wife. He said, we won a victory, and then we stopped. And the enemy regrouped, and then we would have to fight them again. And that seemed to be a part of his military philosophy, was to engage the enemy and continue to engage him and wear him out. And that seems to be formed from the Mexican War, and it was certainly something he learned in the Civil War, was because the Union had the superiority, and they could press it home. And that's what eventually ended the war.
It's very striking. It was very curious and interesting to me, because that was not Grant's private personality. He wasn't aggressive at all in private life. But on the battlefield, conducting campaigns, he was as aggressive as could be, and you hit it exactly. You hit the enemy, you hit him again, you hit him again. And the belief was that that is the way you would win the war. And this is what brought Grant to the attention of Lincoln. Lincoln went through five generals before he got to Grant, and the problem with all the other generals was they either wouldn't give the order in the first place to engage the battle, or if they did, they wouldn't follow up. And so Lincoln got terribly frustrated with George McClellan, for example, who refused to follow up early victories and could have pinned Lee against the Potomac River and ended the war right there. But he didn't. He let Lee get away, and Lincoln was just tearing his hair until he saw that Grant was somebody who would fight. And this is what Lincoln said about Grant. You know, he's my general. He will fight. And that's why Lincoln brought Grant east to take on Lee finally in the last campaign of the war.
I love the quote, the Lincoln quote that ends one of the chapters. Lincoln says, well, this is the first general I've ever had, because usually when I have a general, he comes in and tells me what he's going to do. And this general just came in and said, well, I'm off. I'm going to fight.
One of the great parts of the story, at least as I interpreted, was the relationship that developed between Grant and Lincoln. Grant admired Lincoln tremendously. He knew that Lincoln was doing stuff that he, Grant, never could do. Lincoln provided a moral sandal. Lincoln provided political leadership during the war. And Lincoln recognized in Grant something that he, Lincoln, could never have done. Lincoln was a reluctant commander-in-chief. He certainly didn't want to be general-in-chief. He wanted someone who could devise a military strategy and not even necessarily share it with him. In fact, one of the bits of advice that Lincoln gave Grant and then Grant got from other people was, when you're preparing a campaign, just tell the president in very broad terms what you're going to do. Don't burden him with any details, in part because Lincoln couldn't keep a secret.
So what's the one thing you discovered about Grant that probably most people don't know about his presidency as far as a success of the presidency?
The thing that surprised me most was Grant's sophistication in dealing with economic and financial policy. In 1873, there was a financial panic, not unlike the financial panic of 2008. And Grant had to decide what the appropriate action to take. In those days, there was no Federal Reserve System. And so Congress and the president, between them, made monetary policy. Congress passed a bill that was generally known as the inflation bill. It was going to expand the currency by printing money, literally printing money, in very much the way that the Fed today metaphorically prints money with so-called quantitative easing. The bill landed on Grant's desk. He had to decide whether to accept the bill or veto the bill. And he couldn't decide at first. And so what he did was he wrote out an argument in favor of accepting the bill. And he read it, and I don't know. So then he wrote out an argument in favor of vetoing the bill. And he read that one over, and he went back and forth, and he finally decided that the bill needed to be vetoed. He thought that the arguments in favor of the veto were stronger than the arguments in favor of acceptance. But in writing these, he showed a surprisingly modern understanding of the way money works, of how the quantity of money helps determine the price level, and what the effect would be on the expectations of Americans and American businesses. I hadn't expected that at all. And even now, I don't know how and where Grant arrived at this sophisticated view. But there it was.
Hmm. Now, one of your primary sources is the memoirs. For those who are interested in Grant, would you recommend going back to this book as far as, you know, it's written with the help of Mark Twain, Sam Clemens?
I have to correct you there, because it was widely assumed that it was written with the help of Mark Twain. No, in fact, one of the things that I concluded after having read all of Grant's letters and orders during the Civil War, and I've read most of what Mark Twain wrote. Twain was a wonderful writer, but his style was so at odds with Grant. With Twain, you get the wink of the eye in every other sentence. You get this rather florid style. Grant's style is as spare as can be, and it came from his long practice of giving orders during wartime. The primary thing you're looking for when you write orders is clarity and succinctness.
Yeah, so simplicity, yeah.
Yes, and that is the style of Grant's memoir. And so if you read the memoir, having read the letters, you know this is exactly the same writer. But there's a really interesting aspect to that story, because Twain did become Grant's publisher. He really wasn't Grant's editor. Grant hardly had an editor at all. But Grant was writing the memoir, and he would send the chapters to Twain. Now, Twain didn't respond, because Twain was in awe of Grant as the great hero of the age, and he thought that he had no business commenting on or even editing Grant's prose when Grant was writing about the Civil War. So he just accepted the chapters as they were and sent them off to the printer. Well, Grant, expecting some feedback from this world-famous author and getting none, was getting worried that, oh, my God, he must hate my prose. But in fact, and so they went for quite a while where there was this fundamental misunderstanding. But it turned out to be the best bargain that Twain ever made. Twain made a pile of money on Grant's memoir, which became the first well-known memoir by any president, the first really celebrity memoir in American history, and it remains a wonderful starting point for understanding the Civil War. I say that it is the best memoir ever written by a former president, but that's kind of deliberately misleading. Grant doesn't write about his presidency at all. Huh. He writes about the Civil War. But it is, if somebody wants to read about the Civil War, this is as good a place to start as any, because you engage the mind, the intelligence, the perspective of somebody who is right in the middle of things. And one of the things that gives it such power and poignancy is the fact that it was written while Grant was dying of cancer, and he knew it. And so it takes on the air and the authority of deathbed testimony. It's clear that Grant really is beyond grinding axes or anything like that. He admits where he was wrong. He gives credit to the opposing generals where they did something noteworthy. There's a very generous tone to it, as well as an exceedingly authoritative tone.
Well, that sounds like a good reason for reassessment as any with Ulysses S. Grant. The name of the book, The Man Who Saved the Union. Bill Brands, thanks very much for joining us again.
Great to talk to you, Rich.
Historian H.W. Brand speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses Grant in War and Peace. It's published by Doubleday. He'll be a guest of Booksmart Tulsa and Gilcrease Museum this Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.